Welcome to the Sum of It All Universal Design for Learning podcast. I'm Audrey Mendeville, along with my colleague Mark Alcorn from the San Diego County Office of Education. And this season, we're exploring the third edition of UDL Now, a teacher's guide to applying universal design for learning by Katie Novak. Transcripts to our podcasts are always available for you in the episode notes on your favorite platform.
Well, Audrey, Katie does not waste any time getting into a couple of things that she has on her mind about choice. I could almost picture her going to conferences and all kinds of conversations and emails and direct messages on Twitter. And she comes right out and says, one of the knocks on UDL by critics is that there's an overemphasis on choice in service of learning styles or preferences. And she's just comes right out and reminds us that learning styles has been debunked, and that just this idea of choice, like taking on a life of its own and not being grounded in really the principles of UDL. I really thought it was great how she just came right out of the gate with that, Audrey.
She totally did. I really appreciated that too. You know, and just discussing just for a little bit there about that choice, not for choice sake. You and I always say that it's not about preference, mm-hmm. but it's really about engagement and becoming an expert learner. And I think that people can look at that and say, that's a fine line between preference and engagement. But the reality is like, we're not going around saying like, what do you prefer? Like, I just want to make you comfortable. Like, no, it's not about comfort. It's about being engaged in the learning and learning how to make those decisions about what fits best for you in different situations.
Yeah, good point, Audrey. But, you know, as we dive into this conversation, here's the question, right? Is what is the sweet spot for math regarding choice? And like, what does choice even look like as we get into mathematics lessons?
That's a great, great question. I think we're going to dive into that deeply this episode for sure. I think just before we get too deep into the weeds of that, I think it's important to maybe spend a moment just talking about that the choice in math or in any content area is really about building student agency and the ability for students to make decisions for themselves about what they're learning and how they're learning. And there's this great quote on page 135. It comes from another educator and author, Sean Michael Morris. And they say, agency does not give us power over another, but it gives us mastery over ourselves. And an education that does not encourage or facilitate this agency is not an education. An education that convinces us of what needs to be known, what is important versus what is frivolous, is not an education. It's training at best, conscription at worst. Mm. And all it prepares us to do is believe what we're told. And like everything I hear from educators is like, we are trying to help students become productive citizens of the world and globally responsible and understand how to make choices, right? That is like, we are not going about trying to build robots. Like none of us are in the widget business. We are all about helping students to become empowered individuals who can live wonderful lives and make our world a better place. Like that's all. I mean, you get into like why people are teachers. It's that. It's not
right.
Making little copies of ourselves, you know, over time. And so I just think it's powerful to go back to like the reason that we put choice into what we're doing is not for choice sake. It's to build student agency.
It's super important, Audrey. And you reminded me that oftentimes in education, we're very guilty of getting to the what, like the what is choice? Make sure you're doing choices. But we lose the fact of like, why are we doing choice again? And I like how you brought that student agency as the result of doing the choice work. So as I'm thinking about this, Audrey, you know, choice increases engagement, and Katie talks about that, and it's closely related to decision-making. A phrase that you've heard me say before is us thinking, how many decisions are our students making during a mathematics lesson? That's a lens that I use when I'm teaching lessons. But one thing I want to just mention is that the tricky thing is ensuring that the choices the students are making related to their thinking and problem solving are their choices versus me as the teacher coming up with all these choices that may not be driven from the students. So that's something I'm kind of grappling with as I read this chapter.
Yeah, it's super hard to get our own bias and perspective out of the way. That, I mean, we've talked about that for episodes, right? Like this is the, I think the thing that we keep going back to as educators is like, if I only see the world through my own lens, right? So these are the choices that I can think of, and that's all we offer students, then we are back to this very narrow space. So it's a good space. It's a good place for us to kind of challenge our own assumptions about what choices should be available and what they could look like for students.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know what I'm wondering, Audrey, maybe what we could do right now with our listeners is maybe we just take the three principles of UDL and we just play them out a little bit, just out loud here around mathematics, and just think about, like, thinking of the three principles, and we'll start with engagement, is like, where could those choices reside within that principle so that we can kind of maybe start thinking about some practical ways this could play out?
Sure. Yeah. So let's start with like engagement, right? The why. That if we had just maybe like a word problem or a context, like I've seen in CGI, cognitively guided instruction, I've definitely seen in different problem types where they've given students different number choices, right? So like, do this word problem, but do it with 5 and 10, or do it with 19 and 22, right? Like that to me seems like a space where it kind of, the access or the ability to enter into the problem, the ability to be there, is a choice. Does that sound like a possibility?
Yeah, I think that makes sense to me, Audrey. And as I'm thinking about the representation principle, you know, the what of the learning, you know, the idea that they're, for kids to access a particular type of, back to a contextual problem, there could be some different ways for them to comprehend that particular problem. There could be a discussion, there could be watching a video, there could be even some choice within the task itself, or maybe there's a way to read the prompt. You know, you were mentioning the other day that we were talking about in our last episode, we were talking about Peter's way that he launches a task in terms of him just giving a little bit of information about the task and the students working together to comprehend that. And then I could see that there could be a written version of the task as a further resource for students, that that's a choice that they could make because they know as a learner, that's a strength of theirs, and that really gets them more, that just gives them more preparation to be ready to be part of that discussion with their peers.
Yeah, so you're making me realize, and I think we've talked about this off air before, is that engagement and representation are so closely tied. Because as soon as you say that, I want to go back and like revise my answer for engagement and talk about like, you could have a three-act task in the first video, the context building, or students could actually go and investigate. I think in our multilingual learner book, we talked about how the author took the video of actually going to the store, right? Like all of those pieces kind of build a why there too. And also push into the representation of the what. So knowing that those are really closely tied, like there's spaces for choice in that space too. Like, how do you make sense of that context, or how do you understand what that context looks like? What about action and expression for you? What are you thinking about how they might show what they're thinking?
Well, I think that this one's in terms of choice seems a little bit more clear to me, because it seems that in mathematics, especially over the last few years, we've really emphasized this idea of students showing their thinking in more than one way, and them having choice in which way makes the most sense to them. I think this can be really helpful for us as we try to dispel the notion it's about a kid showing how to solve a problem four different ways. You know, the Common Core nightmare stories, right, Audrey, where, you know, parents are like, why does my kid have to show it four different ways? And yeah, that was maybe not what was intended. So, but valuing the choice in like a kid saying, this makes the most sense to me, I'm going to use this solution strategy, or for this context, I'm going to use this solution strategy. I really think that choice plays out really nicely with that. What do you think?
Yeah. And if the intent is to make their thinking and understanding visible for themselves to monitor their own progress towards their goal, and for the teacher to monitor their progress towards a goal, I think that that kind of choice becomes really valuable, because you can have those conversations around, what'd you choose? Why'd you choose that? And now what do I see in terms of what you understand?
Oh, I love that. That's great. That would make great discussion within students or with the whole class. That's a great point. You know, as we go through the chapter, Audrey, I don't know if you noticed that Katie brings in this quick piece around collaboration, and there's just something that just jumped out at me. And I'm curious what you're thinking about it. Is she mentions collaboration as a possible choice. In other words, kids opting in or opting out of working with other students. And boy, that had sent my brain thinking a bunch of different things. And one of the things that came to mind first is like, boy, I really had that happen in my classroom, you know, more than once where, you know how it works, how you spend lots of time thinking about, okay, these kids are going to work together and spending all that time sort of like doing this big, you know, chart, like, you know, after school till whatever time, right? Making sure that you have it, you know, right, just right. Mm-hmm. And then like, and then inevitably a kid's like, Mr. Alcorn, do I have to work in this group? Can I work by myself? Mm-hmm. And so like, but you know, anyway,
it's a great question. Like she leaves it open to this idea of like, should it be a choice? And, you know, we've all experienced it. The child who says, I want to work by myself, the parent who writes the email or the note to school that says, my child wants to work by themselves, who for various reasons are more comfortable working by themselves. But like when we read Building Thinking Classrooms and Peter Liljedahl talks about visibly random groups, like there's an equity issue at play when we allow students to work independently all the time. And I'm not saying like this is a black and white situation. No, this is like always in groups, but like part of our work as educators is helping our students learn to work with other people. It has to be like they're, and you know, to the end of like, if a child realizes that is like the worst possible outcome, they will look for a career pathway where they don't have to work with other people. But by and large, we all have to interact with other people every day of our lives. And part of what we need to help students grow and be able to do is navigate all the different people in the world that they're going to interact with. And that's why the collaboration is so important. You know, there are jobs, I'm sure, where you get to pick who you work with. I don't usually get to pick who I work with. I'm usually told who I get to work with, you know? And so when you think about that, like teachers, we get a class of students that are handed to us. Like we don't go through and hand pick who our students are. Right. We're given these folks, and we got to learn to work with them. And in the same way, students will grow into their own careers and likely have situations where they have to work with people that are not handpicked by themselves. So I think there's probably less, I would say maybe it's not always a choice, I guess. I think that's a dangerous space to go to.
I agree with you completely. And I'm thinking back to when I did the work that I did, I wish I would have known more about variability because I have to admit when I put kids into groups, I think I was doing one size fits all.
Yeah,
I don't think I was giving the proper supports that I know now with UDL. And so I think I could make it more supportive because maybe some of those students that didn't want to work in a group had a very good reason because I had not constructed the environment for them to be successful.
That's a great point. So another topic in choice, we know this is coming because we've seen these all over the internet, Twitter, social media, other spaces, are choice boards. Are we going to talk about choice boards?
Yeah, boy, talking about choice is one thing in mathematics, but what does a choice board look like in mathematics? And I have to say, Audrey, I'm going to be honest, right where my brain went to right away is like, how is this student-directed versus teacher-directed? Back to the thing about if the teacher's going to just give four ways to solve the problem, and then it could lower the cognitive demand because now the student's just saying, oh, the teacher's just telling me what to do. I have four choices, but this teacher is still just telling me what to do. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm thinking of now is like, maybe you and I have used a resource that was in our 2013 framework, which is the Standards for Mathematical Practice alongside some questions that activate those particular practices. So one of the questions might be, what mathematical tools would help to represent this situation? So I'm wondering, like, would a question like that provide choices, but the power would still be in the student to make the choice? So I'm sort of wondering, what do you think about an example like that with a question like that as an activator of choice?
I like the question, but but the yeah buts, you knew it was coming.
Yeah, I kind of felt it coming.
She Katie introduces in this chapter Barry Schwartz, who talks about the paradox of choice. And if you haven't seen that TED Talk or read the book, it's super interesting because we've all experienced it where if it's 100, I think she uses the 175 salad dressings, like then which one are you going to pick? You almost just stand there. You're like, I don't know. Like versus if you have kind of this smaller number of choices between 2 and 6, it's easier for us to make a choice and maximize our satisfaction with the choice, which is a super interesting, it's a super interesting TED Talk if you have time to watch it. So I think what I hear you saying is like, I think the prompts from those questions from the Standards for Mathematical Practice are really powerful. So I love the prompt that you came up with, like what mathematical tools would help represent this situation. But as it is right there, Mark, that feels totally paralyzing. It feels like I could use any tool. So like what I guess right. I would say is like, how could you make that a smaller number? Could you say like, hey, would graphing paper, a calculator, a table of values, or some counting tools be helpful, right? And that's 4. Right. I was once in a workshop with James McKenna, who does a lot of work here in California on UDL.
Right.
And he gave us 3 choices, but then said something along the lines of, or you choose something else. And that might feel super scary as a teacher, depending on the level of your kids, the age of your kids. But the 3 choices or saying that we could do something else felt very empowering. And he was very careful and thoughtful about checking in with us about what we had chosen, so that if you had chosen one that you made up on your own, he was checking. He wasn't just like going to let you go for like an hour and then be like, whoops, you made a bad choice. Like you should have chosen one of the ones I gave you. But like instead, like gave us some autonomy to like start down our pathway with our choice, one of the 3 we had or the one we chose from ourselves. And then he checked in with us to make sure we were making progress on what we needed to do. And so I think there's probably like there's a sweet spot there. 2 to 6 choices, maybe some autonomy with like or choose your own option as well.
A great point, Audrey. And as you were talking, I did think of a specific example with a kindergarten teacher I used to work with, where she had the different tools out and available, and the kids would have to choose which one they were going to use, and she didn't tell them. So it actually is a real life example of exactly what you're just talking about.
That's perfect. So they're like readily available right there in their purview. Like they can see them, right? And especially at kindergarten, that's super important. Like it's super tangible. I love that. Mm-hmm. So another topic from this chapter, which definitely we can put our math lens on, is discussions. So Katie spends a bit of time talking about classroom discussions and choice in there. What do you think about what she had to say?
Well, there's a quote on 139 that says, not leaving classroom discussions to chance. I really agree with Katie on that. She brings up popsicle sticks. I will bring up cold calling, which is popsicle sticks can be a form of cold calling. And all of those are what I call potential conversation killers. In other words, the flow of the conversation, if somebody doesn't have something to say within that conversation, can really limit the engagement of everybody in the conversation, actual learning as a product. So I think that having choice within discussions and thinking about what that looks and sounds like for students, and I think is important for us to consider.
Yeah, I really appreciate that, Mark, because you know, I definitely did popsicle sticks at one point in my career. Like I was there because I thought I was doing it for the right reason. And you're so right, when it comes to a discussion, it's problematic. And even when you think about like, I'm doing it for equity of voice, when the student's name gets called, you know, she just even talks about like, if that at the moment in time is not when you have something to share, then no learning is happening. You're totally missing it. So this kind of goes back to me with this piece around goals. She shares that like research has several reasons to have discussions. Maybe it's better informed understanding on the topic, increased self-awareness. Maybe it's building academic vocabulary and language, other things. But you have to start with your goal or your purpose, just like in any UDL, right? Like start with the goal, then that design to eliminate barriers.
Yeah, for sure, Audrey. What comes to mind is the Smith and Stein book, that's 5 practices for orchestrating discussions, and how it's about having that goal. And it really gets back to our last episode. Like if I have this goal in mind, this is the learning goal I want my students to reach by the end of the lesson, then I need to make sure that the discussion that we have is centered around that learning goal so that my students know that that's a through line throughout the whole lesson. And so I think what that's a good reminder for me also, Audrey, is that the end is not about the discussion. It's not about having some sort of performance. And there's definitely a time in my career that I was so excited about what my students were doing in a discussion that I think that at times I wasn't thinking of what the purpose of the discussion was. They were talking about math and doing an amazing job, but like, what is the learning? What is the purpose of the discussion? Because it's only a vehicle for the learning.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. So in terms of then, like, once you have that goal in mind, the eliminating barriers, there's a super interesting graphic on page 140 around like barriers and thinking about those both in informal discussions to formalized discussions. But like when you start to like think about what all your fears or what the barriers could be, I think it's worthwhile to like list them down because then you plan for it, right? Then the idea is that you are designing to make those into opportunities instead. So if the structure doesn't support student agency and creativity, okay, what is it that I can do instead in order to allow them to have agency and in order to allow them creativity? So I think it's helpful to like slow down a little bit on those and just be conscious of the fact that like when we're like, hey class, let's have a discussion without a purpose and without consciously thinking about what the barriers are and designing around it, we're probably not actually having a fantastic learning environment.
Well said, well said. Well, Audrey, there's one more section that we should touch on before we wrap up, which is about feedback. And as I thought about the word feedback and I took it into mathematics and thought about like my experience as a learner in learning mathematics, and I have to say it was limited to me being told as a student, this is right and this is wrong. And usually the teacher telling the class, why weren't you paying attention? That sort of is the kind of feedback, whether it be a test or homework or whatever, it's usually just kind of this right or wrong. And then some sort of admonition about the reason that you were wrong must have had to do with you not being able to replicate something that the teacher's doing. So I wonder, what are you thinking about this section around feedback, Audrey?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing to think about. And part of what I think we push up against is we can only give feedback based on the types of things we ask initially, right? So like if the question only elicits a right or wrong answer, that's the only kind of feedback I can give versus if it's a different kind of prompt or activity, like there's more space for it, right? So a lot of her examples are definitely tended towards ELA processes and things. So probably need to rethink some of those for math or rethink the kinds of problems we're giving. I did like one, I would love to give a shout out to one that was in there that I appreciated that we've used more recently, which is the idea of the prompt of like, I used to think and now I think. And when students do that, that leaves us a little bit more space to then think about the learning journey and provide both providing us feedback that we need, the important feedback we need in order to like think about their next steps, but also provides them some feedback in terms of them thinking about where their next steps are. But I'm curious, what are you thinking are some other options? What's better than kind of our right, wrong, and other things?
Yeah. As I was getting to the end of the chapter, Audrey, there's a great, great little section on asking students for feedback. So as the educator, how could I ask them to give me some feedback? And I just, as you know, I have high school kids in my household, and they come back and tell me some things about their lessons. That are not overly critical toward the lessons, but are super, super reflective about things that happen in the lessons. And I'm thinking, boy, if their teacher could just hear some of these really reflective things they're thinking about, how much that could just really support them in meeting the needs of their learners.
It's so true. And, you know, Katie even says, like, when she gets asked by teachers, where should they begin their UDL journey? So, like, if this is where you're wondering, you're like, there's all this stuff, where do I begin? She says, and I think this is great advice, ask the students. Yeah. Like they're going to tell you, when you interview them, they're going to tell you spaces that you could provide better choice. They're going to tell you spaces where we're designing for average student and not for variability. And so I just really appreciate, I just truly appreciate that she shares that.
Yeah, yeah, that for sure, Audrey. And, you know, I just, there's a quote that's near the end of the chapter there that I just think epitomizes what you're talking about, which is start to weave their voices into your practice. I love that verb weave, start to weave the student voices into your practice. I just love that phrase. It really has to do with how we center power in our classrooms and who the classroom is designed for. Is it about me as a teacher and my favorite story problems that I'm giving for mathematics or context or whatever? Or is it about weaving my students' voices into the environment?
I love that phrase, Mark. I'm glad you brought that out. And I think that's a great space for us to kind of just remind ourselves, like, students are partners in this journey. Like, when we want to create something that's student-centered, we have to treat them as partners. And so weaving their voices into our practice is the perfect way, the entryway to get that going.
Oh, I so agree. Thanks for joining us for this episode. Our next episode, we will wrap up the book with chapter 8, which is called, But What About Standardized Assessments? Mm. Until then, send us a tweet with the hashtag SumMathChat. That's hashtag SumMathChat with your questions and thoughts. We'll keep the conversation going there. Until then, best wishes on rethinking our practices.